Welcome to the National MPS Society Our Voices podcast. Join us as we strive for the betterment of lives in the MPS and ML community. We talk with inspirational leaders in our community, scientists, physicians, therapists, researchers, families, and leaders, supporting families with the resources they need. Let your voice be heard.
Thank you for tuning in to the National MPS Society's official podcast, Our Voices. I'm your host, Stephanie Posey. Today, I have the pleasure to share with you the personal stories of two incredibly inspiring individuals. It isn't often that you get to meet someone who had such a profound impact on your life. As many of you know, my son Ethan was diagnosed with MPS1-Purler syndrome when he was 9 months old, started enzyme replacement therapy shortly after, and had a bone marrow transplant by his first birthday. Navigating the difficulties of a devastating diagnosis and treatment, searching the internet for whatever I could find about my son's condition, one story I came across was the glimmer of hope I needed. It was the story of Ryan Dant. Today, I have the privilege and the honor to introduce to you Ryan Dant and Dr. Emil Kakis, who led the development and approval of enzyme replacement therapy, Aldurazyme, a drug that is now the standard of care for MPS1, a drug that went through too many obstacles before becoming the treatment so many families in our community had hoped for and desperately needed. In his recent book, Saving Ryan, Dr. Kakis passionately chronicles his research and mission to treat patients with MPS1, for which he is here to share with us today. Thank you, Ryan and Dr. Kakis, for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Excellent. Dr. Kakis, let's talk about your book, Saving Ryan. What inspired you to write this book?
Well, there are many reasons, but I felt that the struggle of a family to figure out a way to save their child and to connect with a scientist at the beginning of their career was an important concept for them to think about in dealing with their own children. Every week, thousands of kids get diagnosed with new rare diseases that many of which have no treatment at all. Many parents are in the same position Mark Dant was in. The book gives them an outline of what it could be like for an average person and family to get struck by genetic lightning and to fight through the struggle, the pain, to find a way to be active and create a solution and save your child.
Now, there are several threads throughout your book, and you had described them to me previously. Would you mind going over a couple of them with us?
The first one I just stated was families finding and developing. The second one was about biotechnology and the science that involved in putting it together and developing it and what it takes. So there's some learning that there's. I think one of the real important thing relates to the public policy about drug development and what it takes to get a rare disease drug approved. In the story, you learn that in the early days, the beginning, the FDA played a prominent role in accelerating the work by giving us the opportunity to get into the clinic and breaking down barriers. And that was so important at actually getting success at all. And then we ran into changes at the FDA, and it became more difficult, more cynical, more difficult. And we ended up losing a lot of time. And with that delay in time, we ended up spending a lot more money. And more tragically, we lost a number of patients who didn't get treated because of that delay. And so the book, one of the important threads is we need to do better in how we regulate and manage the treatment so the science we have is reaching patients that need it.
Now, reaching patients that need it, that is basically what this book is centered around, delivering drug to the patient, how you're going to do that. You take the time to look back at different moments and individuals that guided you in some way to that moment in that room, giving the drug to patient for the first time. You mentioned your father, his practice as a physician, and the deep respect you have for the researchers that paved the way to your work. You mentioned how enzyme replacement therapy wasn't exactly the bright and shiny science that you originally had wanted to work with. And if you wouldn't mind sharing with us a little bit about the influential people in your life and your career decisions that ultimately led to this drug development.
Growing up with my father, who was a neurologist and a very good neurologist and highly respected. And I learned at a time when I didn't think I was going to be a doctor about what it takes to be a great doctor and how sometimes you have to start things that no one's ever done before. And sometimes those things fail and you have to learn how to support your patients or, as I said in the book, hold their hand when things don't go well. And that was very important in my thinking. He also developed a new or worked on a new treatment for Parkinson's disease, so I could see how exciting it was. But at that time, I didn't know I was going to do rare disease drug development. I didn't know I was even going to be a doctor. But those early memories do provide an imprint on my thinking as I moved forward. Another important thread is my other side of the story is Dr. Neufeld, who was a young woman scientist in the 60s when she started working at NIH at a time when there were very few women. And those that were in science, she said, were considered eccentric. But she didn't care. She was hardcore, deeply driven by the science, and discovered a way to treat MPS1 in 1968 and spent the next 30 years working out how to turn that science into something that could be used. But her story kind of led and connected with my story. I was a fellow, and she basically said to me, we finally have the science to be able to replace that enzyme that MPS1 patients are missing. And to me, as a scientist thinking about my career in research, it was a relatively industrial-like project just to make enzyme. It wasn't very sexy science. It was pretty basic. But what I didn't appreciate is that the science may not be fancy, but it's so powerful if it can change the future of the patients in front of you. And that direction she set me on put me on the path to being able to develop a treatment. I trusted her because of her years of experience to guide me, accepted that, and went wholeheartedly at it. And over time, I realized something really important. It doesn't matter how fancy the science is, how cool the journals are. If you don't help anyone, you haven't really done anything. And when you get the chance to take an enzyme therapy and treat kids like Ryan for the first time, you want to do that over and over again for the rest of your career. And you realize, doesn't matter what it is, if it can actually change their future, that's what you want. That's the measure.
Now, she was actually in the room with you with your first patient was receiving enzyme replacement therapy. Could you explain to us what that feeling was like?
When we finally got there, I called her up and I told Liz, we're ready to start this trial. And she said, really? Are you so early, so soon? And she was a little bit nervous. And I said, look, Liz, we're ready to go. And I want you to come down and start the first infusion. And she was a little bit nervous. And if I press the button, what if something happens? I said, nothing's going to happen. It's going to take 4 hours for the infusion to go in. So it's symbolic.
Definitely.
And honestly, after 30 years of work, how could he not let her be in the room and actually treat the patient for the first time? 30 years from figuring out how to treat, I had to give her that symbolic moment, come in, start the first infusion to correct, as she used to call it, the deficiency in MPS1 patients. It was an amazing moment. We captured it on video, and I was so excited to be able to give her thrill of her career at seeing her science come back to the patient.
That's incredible. Throughout the book, it was very obvious in your writing how important developing and guiding your team was. I appreciate the detail that you gave about each team member and every person that contributed to this mission. It was very humbling, especially as a parent. I often think about who all was involved in creating this drug that has positively impacted my son's life and my life. Reading this and getting to know them, and then reading about the struggles and the blows that your team faced over the years, could you tell us how you helped keep them motivated and focused? And one example that comes to my mind is the picture of Ginger that you placed on the lab door.
No matter what project you're doing, it takes more than me. So I didn't do this thing by myself. I started it, but it took a strong and dedicated team to make it. And I learned that early on. I talk about realizing how much I need to find people that were aligned and directed to your goal, that they wanted this, that they wanted as bad as you wanted it. And they were not just taking a job to get paid, but they're taking a job to do something with their lives. And we started building that team that dreams. As we're getting going, for many of them, they had no connection to patients, whereas I had a constant connection to patients who were calling me and waiting, when is this coming? And one of those patients had some clinical problems and had to get surgery for cord compression, named Ginger Griffin. She was a wonderful young woman with milder disease, but mild doesn't mean you're not terrible. She'd had heart valve surgery and she'd had this terrible problem. And I convinced her to go get surgery because I thought the enzyme therapy was coming and she'd be a great candidate. And she went and got the surgery. Then she died the year before we got to the clinic and she couldn't make it. And it brought to home something that I wanted the team to know, is that somewhere right now, there's someone waiting for you, someone who may not make it if we don't get there. I want them to have that sense of urgency and importance on their mind when they enter the lab. So I took a picture of Ginger Griffin and a little inscription. I put it on a plaque right in the front door when you go in the lab. So every day, Ginger Griffin's face. And if you forgot, you remember what we're doing and why getting it done really matters.
It's powerful to put the face to the mission and the heart of that mission. There was also another part where you were talking about the urgency of getting this to patients. I believe it was over a Christmas holiday. It's just reminding your team about how you couldn't put it off any longer. Do you mind telling us a little bit about that?
Well, that year, which is 1997, the team, which was less than 10 people, had been working incredibly hard. It was a 24/7, 7 day a week thing for months. And we were tired, but we were working very hard to get to the clinic because we wanted to treat the patient as soon as possible. As it was getting into December, we were planning to have the first patient treated actually late in December, the week before Christmas. And the team saw that coming, and my head of the lab, Becky Tanimachi, was terrific and great at running the lab and holding them together, by the way, in that stressful year, came to me and said, the team is exhausted. We need a break. If you dose them in December, we won't be able to take Christmas off. And we really want to take a little time off because they've done all this work. And I thought about it for a little bit moment and I said, okay, Becky, so what you're telling me is you want me to call up the family that's coming in for infusion and tell them that you can't come for your first infusion because the team needs a break until next year. And she looked at me as I said that and said, never mind. And that's fine. And a lot of people wonder why was I saying that? I wanted them to understand this is the truth. If it sounds bad, maybe it's because it is bad. And that's not to say they didn't work hard or not to say they didn't deserve a break. But right now, at the beginning of it, the very first patient, putting it off would crush that family and disrupt a lot of people. Fortunately, that team held it together. Crazy year and a crazy year after that. But honestly, there was such a great return when we got to be in the room in December and see the first kid treated with all the work that we did. There's no better moment than that.
That's awesome. Ryan, you're here today and you were patient number three. And as I am reading through all the accounts from your father and your mother and Dr. Kakis, there are a lot of things that I start to think about and something that I relate to your family with. When will he start to notice that maybe he's different or that he has NPS? And so my question for you is, at what age or what time frame did you start to notice that you were maybe different from the other children? And when did you realize the severity of your condition?
I think I didn't really notice I was that different because, yes, I was going to a lot of doctor's appointments prior to getting the first dose, and I was getting sent home with terrible headaches and vomiting and passing out for the night. But I just didn't really connect it with my age group that I was any different. But then when we went out to UCLA in 98 for the first trial for my first dose, that's when I started to actually notice that the severity of it, because I'm thinking, I haven't heard any kids in my class going to a doctor and having to do medicine and things of this nature. But now here I am out at UCLA Harbor, spending a couple of months out here, and I'm getting a medicine. And I'm thinking, wow, this must be bad. Well as I had to skip a couple of weeks prior to that to skip school and then get all my schooling done in Los Angeles at a local grade school there too. So I had to change all my regular habits to move everything to California for the clinical trial.
And that's a lot transitionally for a child at 9 years old. There was a story of where your father was laying next to you in the middle of the night, and you had a very profound statement about asking him what death was like. Do you remember that conversation with your dad?
I remember it a little bit because that was probably one of the days I had a bad headache. And I was just getting tired of having the bad headaches. And I just thought to myself, what's next? So I asked my dad, what was death like?
As a parent, that's a tough one.
Family support is key to the National MPS Society's mission. Visit mpssociety.org/support to learn about the ways we continue to assist families in every way possible. Whether it's through support programs like Pathways, bereavement expense, medical travel assistance, family conference scholarships, continuing education scholarships, and more. You can apply online and get the support you need. You can also find an exhaustive collection of links to helpful resources. You're not alone. Visit mpssociety.org/support.
You were talking about being out in California and having to basically pick up your life and move out there with that transition. And knowing, starting to realize that you needed this treatment, your family did a great job of advocating for you and fundraising and trying to find this treatment. And here it is, you finally have it. Did that change your perspective and outlook on life as a 9-year-old?
I think it did because I hadn't really noticed any difference since anything different, like getting medicine, needing to get medicine. But once I got the first dose, I was realizing maybe there is something drastically different that I need to do. And let's see how long this medicine lasts. And I remember Dr. Kakis and I had a little bet going on prior to pushing the button that he bet me $10 that I would feel better soon. Thankfully, I didn't take that bet because he would have won it.
Your parents did an excellent job raising awareness, and a lot of that came out in features like with 60 Minutes and articles in Reader Digest. Even our first guest speaker, Isabel, she read this article that brought her hope. And she was in Guatemala at the time. And so this, you were very much in the public light and in the spotlight, especially representing our community. What was it like growing up and being a public figure for MPS?
I didn't really notice that I was a public figure. And so one time when my family and I went out to Florida for a family vacation, we had a random family come up to us and say, weren't you in such and such article? And I was like, oh, wow, we're all the way in Florida and people are talking about our story. Then later that night, we went to an ice cream shop and we saw the Reader's Digest cover. And I was like, holy cow, this is big news if this is making it all the way to Florida. And that's when I started to really gravitate or acknowledge that, yes, I am leading the way and being type of an image. For the MPS community is just amazing to see.
Absolutely. Do you feel like that's helped shape your life, like being in the public spotlight for MPS?
I think it has because when I was younger, my parents always told me not let this disease defeat me. Try to live a normal, aka normal life to the best that I can. And so that's what I did. I went to grade school, got treated as normal as possible, then went to a new high school, and we were worried that I'd get treated differently, but luckily I was treated just like any normal kid, normal high schooler, just join the football and baseball teams there and then do a weekly IV infusion at home and just gradually continue to grow up and go through the normal life of growing up as a teenager and now young adult.
I know your parents are very proud. I'm proud as well. I think we all can say that. Obviously, one of the biggest milestones in this journey to save Ryan was being able to get drug to the first patient and in the first clinical trials. There was a lot of detail describing the process from its humble beginnings in the dingy UCLA lab and a lot of information learning about GMP standards and so on. Dr. Kakis, what do you think were the most difficult challenges and the best lessons learned in your process?
We were beginning in a place that had no experience and no history of making a product for human use at all. So I didn't know anything, nor was the place really appropriate. We were in World War II era bungalows that had been there for 50 years and were worn down and falling apart. The only advantage of that space is that I had a lot of space. So that means I had room. The biggest learning was that it doesn't matter what you want to do if you don't learn the practical details of what are required to actually produce a drug for human use, then it's not going to happen. And that means all of the mechanical and simple things, the pieces have to be put together and to assembled into a controlled manufacturing process to make a product and put it in a vial that you can give to people was incredibly difficult and gave me great respect for what it takes to manufacture biotechnology products of the quality and care required. We had to learn a lot about good manufacturing practice, rules and regulations, but the truth was a lot of those rules and regulations are very superficial. The standards are almost unknowing. And so the other big lesson is you have to hire people that have experience, that know this stuff, because it's not like it's all written down in a textbook. You can look it all up. Every situation's different. It requires hiring talent with experience. We're able to get a few people that had experience, and the rest of us went to classes and took classes on how to become GMP compliant. And what a crazy year it was, but we all learned it. Great people helped us. And we managed to get it done, even in the dingy old World War II era bungalow.
And that was even before modern internet and Google's search engines and all the information just available to us. So I definitely have an appreciation for the work then. And in my opinion, some of the most intense chapters in the book are the ones detailing the ADCOM meeting that eventually recommended the FDA approval with a 12-0 vote, and I believe you titled it Yes for Life. Spoiler alert, I obviously know that the drug gets approved. My son, he's been fortunate enough to be able to receive Aldurazyme. But as you detail this meeting, so many emotions are evoked in me as a parent and as a reader, listening to the patient testimonies and just the exchanges with the panel. One of the most interesting things I found is that you didn't mention about conceiving your idea for the Every Life Foundation. That was something that I had talked to you about in a previous interview leading up to now. Would you mind telling us a little bit more about how you conceived that idea and why you wanted to pursue creating this nonprofit?
I think one of the things you understand is an advisory committee is where outside experts are brought in by the FDA to advise them. What came out of that meeting is the outside expert said 12-0, the drug was working. And the FDA had said they weren't sure and they wanted to do another trial. The fact that group of experts could have such a different opinion told you there's a problem, right? There's a problem with what's happening at the FDA and how we're approaching development. And that problem was that we're taking good science and we don't understand it. And therefore, we're creating difficulties at translating it into an approved treatment. At that meeting, I realized that the views we had on this were right, and the FDA was not right, and their opinions on biomarkers, on the trial design, and other aspects were not necessarily the right ones for a rare disease. And so I decided there, that point, that when I have a chance, I want to develop a foundation that was going to focus on improving the process of drug development for rare diseases. So that kind of situation doesn't happen. So we don't have those delays that are unnecessary, that we figure out how to take the science and get it through the system, and that you have an FDA that wants to help and collaborate and drive quality of what we do higher and ensure that drugs are safe and effective and that we get it done promptly. And so the foundation's goal was to take on whatever we had to at a policy level to change the pathway and the ability to innovate for rare disease patients with biotechnology.
So one of my earliest interactions with the rare disease community after my son's diagnosis was attending an advocacy week in DC, and it was hosted by the Every Life Foundation and RDLA. And it was just such an incredible event, getting to meet other rare disease patients and family members, advocates, networking with such incredible people in positions that could really help our families. And just empowering us to be able to use our voices to provide that influence with our policymakers. And it was at that trip that actually getting to listen to those stories helped me to develop the idea of developing this podcast and bringing these voices forward. So I just want to thank you for that experience. And it's something that I'm definitely going to encourage others to see.
Yeah, Rare Disease Week is a great event, but it has two features. One is to help parent patients families, mm-hmm. see other families in the same But the second is to bring you together and make sure that Congress sees you too, that you see all of you as a big group, not just as individual rare disease, that your power is being together, and to have 600, 800 rare disease acts that's all going on the Capitol Hill and talking to legislators is an incredibly powerful thing. It's that pulling people together that gives us the strength to change what has to change for rare disease patients.
Absolutely. Some of the most touching yet heartbreaking stories that are shared in your book, Saving Ryan, are in the epilogue, where you give us many updates on the original trial patients. You don't shy away from revealing the heartache and the losses that accompany a disease like MPS. And I can tell how deeply you care for each of your patients and their families. Most of this interview has been centered around how you've changed so many lives. And to this date, that is upwards of 3,000 individuals in MPS1 alone. What I would like to ask you is how interacting with these patients changed your life.
I think the most important thing is to start to realize that science for science sake doesn't make any sense. Science in the service of people, real problems, is powerful. And what this work did and what meeting all these families did was allow me to find my purpose in life, which was to develop as many rare disease treatments as I can to treat as many rare disease patients. And since that time, I've been involved in or had approval for 11 different rare disease treatments, including Aldurazyme. And it's been so powerful to take other communities and bring them their first treatment ever. And that finding that purpose is what really came through. And it came through not only from saving people, but even people that you help and that are lost teach you something about life and the meaning of the struggle that we are in. That the struggle we make as a scientist working with a family is an important part of human endeavor in feeling what makes us special as people. And I can't imagine a better field for one to be in than one where you're helping families find a way forward and work with them, sometimes saving them, sometimes you're holding their hand through this incredible crisis of their lives. Nothing more powerful than doing that.
Absolutely. And I remember the first time that I met you, which was at the Rare Disease Week. It was such a humbling experience to be able to meet the man who had such an influence in developing a drug that could help my son have a better life. So it's a wonderful opportunity to have you here with us talking about all of this. Now, Ryan, it's been almost 25 years since your first dose of Aldurazyme, which has completely altered the course of your life. In the book, your dad mentions that doctors first said, you know what, take him home and love him until you pass. And he just didn't find that to be acceptable. So he sought a treatment. And with that treatment, you've now graduated college. You have a career and you've recently gotten married. Congratulations. What is some advice you would be giving to the other Ryans out there, perhaps younger generation of affected individuals or other rare disease communities that are waiting for that opportunity of treatment?
Never give up. Live life to the fullest. Don't let the disease hold you back from accomplishing anything, because there will be a cure for some of these diseases one day. It's just, you never know. You just got to live life to the fullest.
And as a parent, a lot of this really sounds cliche, but like my entire perspective on life changed when we got this diagnosis. And I feel like I am more capable of living life now just because I know how incredibly precious it is and the opportunity that I have with my son now in this moment. That's definitely some great advice for young adults or maybe teenagers as they age into being an adult. Thank you very much for joining me today. It has been an honor and a privilege to be able to talk with you about your book, Dr. Kakis, Saving Ryan, and Ryan speaking with you about your journey with MPS and treatment. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I am Stephanie Cozine, your host for this episode of Our Voices, the official podcast of the National MPS Society. I want to thank our guest speakers, Dr. Emil Kakis and Ryan Dant, for joining us today and sharing their experiences and personal stories. If you would like to read Dr. Emil Kakis' book, Saving Ryan, it is available for digital purchase for Kindle on Amazon. And if you enjoy the traditional page-turner, a hard copy will be available soon. Thank you to the volunteers and staff that made this episode possible. If you want to learn more about NPS or would like to donate to the National NPS Society's mission, check out our website at www.npssociety.org. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Make sure to tune in to our latest episodes dropped on the last Tuesday of each month. Looking forward to sharing more of our voices.
Thanks for listening to the National NPS Society's Our Voices podcast. If you found this information valuable, please consider giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and share this podcast with a friend. You'll be helping to support more families in the NPS and ML community. Follow us on Facebook at National NPS Society, Twitter and Instagram at NPS Society. This podcast was produced by Podcast Carry. Music written and performed by Jason Madison and Keith Neal.